Please sit comfortably. Tonight, I am going to talk a little about a koan from the Book of Equanimity. This is a koan from Master Yunmen, who is known in Japanese as Unman. He's like all over the koan collections that we study. One of my favorite lines from Master Yunmen is, he says, every day is a good day. That's a koan that we take up early on in our koan study in this way. For me, that line has actually been kind of a touchstone of my practice, and something that I come back to repeatedly to kind of encounter each moment with gratitude and openness. And this every day is a good day isn't a hey man, yeah, whatever, it's all good. And one of the challenges in taking up that line as a koan is, how is every day a good day when it's a terrible day? How is every day a good day when someone close to you has died? How is it every day a good day when you've inadvertently run over a young child and stone? So, this is case 11 of the Book of Equanimity. Great Master Yunmen said, there are two sicknesses that prevent the light from penetrating. One sickness is where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before you. As a result, the light doesn't penetrate. Another sickness is where you have realized that everything is empty, but you still feel you're in a mist, and so the light does not penetrate thoroughly. About the Dharmakaya, there are also two sicknesses. First, if you reach the Dharmakaya but fall and remain there and do not extinguish your own opinion about it, that's first. Second, if you think it is wrong to give up efforts after enlightenment and minutely examine your own consciousness and find there is no scar, that too is a sickness. So I'm going to talk about all four of those a little bit. So those are either two sicknesses with two subcategories each, or four sicknesses, but the case is called Yunmen's two sicknesses. And these sicknesses are ways that we can use our mind in a suffering-causing fashion, in a suffering-creating fashion. And just to gloss this word Dharmakaya, Dharmakaya is the ultimate body of the universe, the body of the reality. It's the body of the Buddha that we see pervading everywhere. So, there are two sicknesses that prevent the light from penetrating. So we recited today Tori Zenji Bodhisattva's vow. There's a great image at the beginning of this. Everything reveals the mysterious truth of the universe. This truth never fails. In every moment and every place, things can't help but shine with this light. This is the light of thusness, the light of isness, of enoughness, of its own perfection, of each thing so perfectly being itself. And there are two sicknesses that prevent us from seeing that light, from letting that light penetrate us, from having that light penetrate our awareness, our vision. One sickness is where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before you. So the first two sicknesses here are kind of So all of these things are going to be recurrent, that we come to over and over again in our Zen lives, in our practice of Zazen, and in our experience of ourselves and the world, and also some of them have to do with special states of mind, like on retreat. But these two are sicknesses that we may are sicknesses that we may encounter in the beginning. One is a sickness where everything is unclear and something seems to hang before you. So this is the sickness that first brings us to the great medicine of the Dharma. The Buddha is talked about as the great physician, and one of his diagnoses is that we create suffering with our minds. Before we can avail ourselves of this great medicine that is the Dharma, we have to notice that we're sick. So this sickness is, in a way, it's actually a boon. So this is where everything is unclear. This is that we're feeling confused, that we're feeling that life has to be easier. There has to be a way for us to move more skillfully through their lives, or a sense of kind of the crampedness of our mind, of having no choices, no flexibility, no way no space to turn around in, to move, to open up into. Or this is a sickness where we look at that guy, that Zen teacher, that Zen student over there, that guy writing that book, he's really got something. I need some of that. And something seems to hang before you. So there's that thing in front of you. And that can be, that's a powerful, that thing can be something that pulls us deeper into practice. One of the great and, in fact, comforting truths of Zen is that nobody comes to Zen for the right reason. We all come to it for some variety of the wrong reason. And miraculously, wondrously, joyfully, it doesn't actually matter. And all of the tricks and tools of Zen are to kind of help us get past our reason for coming. And then, of course, we have to find the reason why we stay and the reason why we come back. And none of us do any of those things for the right reason. So, rest assured. And so there's a way in which these sicknesses, these four sicknesses, or these two times two sicknesses, proceed kind of linearly in a kind of stages of practice kind of way. And there's another way that we can, if we look closely, we see them constantly unfolding, into each other one after another, even in the space of one period of zazen. The second sickness. So I want to say a little more about the first sickness. This is where we're grunting and straining our way towards enlightenment, or towards breaking through a koan, or to really grasp what it is that the sutras or our teachers are saying when they say form is exactly emptiness. What does that mean, emptiness? That's also part of the first sickness. So the second sickness is where you have realized that everything is empty, but you still feel you're in a mist, and so the light does not penetrate thoroughly. These are sicknesses. It's interesting here. These are sicknesses of light. There are sicknesses, and one of the chants that we rarely do has a really excellent line that says, "Within light there is darkness. But do not try to understand this darkness. Within darkness, there is light. But do not look for this light." So the second sickness is when we start to know that within darkness there is light, and we're looking so vigorously for it. So this is what happens when. This. The lines of the koan says, where you realize that everything is empty. And it doesn't matter how you understand. This everything is empty is kind of just a stand-in for whatever it is, whatever form your realization takes, or whatever form it is that you, you can also say that everything is fine, everything is perfect as it is, or that thought, or you realize that thoughts are just thoughts. So it's whatever little light has gone on for you at any point that has been part of what's pulled you into practice, or whatever you, whatever kind of just transcendentally grateful state you find yourself into on the last day of Sesshin, on the last day of our meditation retreats. Those things are, so when you have realized that everything is empty, or so this is, for me, when I was first working on the koan mu, which is the first koan that we do in koan study in our tradition, you know, so I had an insight into it. But then that, like, passed, you know, and I thought, oh, I get it. I totally get it now. God, that's so great. And then it passed, and I didn't understand it anymore. I didn't understand the thing that I used to understand. I couldn't see the thing that I saw. I didn't have that kind of, fluid freedom that I had, you know, in the last period of Zazen, last week, last year. And so for me, what I was struggling with is, where is Mu when I don't see it? And I kind of knew on an intellectual level that it was like everywhere right before me, but I couldn't see it. And so I knew it was there, but I just couldn't see it. And I thought maybe if I had better Zen binoculars, you know, or if I got my, like, Zen eyes checked by a proper Zen optometrist who could diagnose what exactly is wrong with me, then they could, you know, help me see it better. So and you feel you're in a mist, or that you're kind of plunged into darkness. And so this second sickness is also one. This is one where we're also can come up for us if we're doing. If we're practicing the Zen discipline of just sitting, or shikantaza, and we find ourselves striving to just sit, and we're really trying to do it, and we're kind of leaning into it, and we just can't get, or when we notice we're like bouncing from we're having some kind of emotional response. And we're getting, and we're seeing ourselves kind of moving back and forth, and we have this idea that we should somehow not be doing that, that we should be connecting to some kind of peace below that. And so all of these things are things that kind of arise for us when our thoughts kind of become blindingly huge right in front of our face. But and so the task isn't to cause them to not be there, but to recognize, this is a blindingly huge thought in front of my face. Or if we're falling into striving, if we're falling into trying to fix this moment, rather than trying to suppress that striving or not strive, to recognize that this is that there's just striving present, rather than falling into the story of the striving. That's one of the ways that we can allow the light to penetrate thoroughly. So, but it's also that, when our understanding or our feeling or whatever is unclear and muddy, we think that that's a problem, that muddiness is not the good way it should be. It should be clear and open and the way it was before, or the way we think it is and when we read those books. And so when we see that muddiness or that unclarity, we're actually having a perfectly clear view of muddiness and unclarity, rather than a obscured view of clarity. But we have this idea of the way it should look, and so we're looking at this thing, and then we're telling ourselves a story about it. But it's just that. And this is what I've expressed before, that kind of occurred to me as, you know, in the context of colors, that when we're seeing like red is not a failed version of blue. Red is red, blue is blue. And to recognize when there and that those are each different forms that a moment can take, that a thought form can take. And to just recognize that, to recognize that we're seeing red when we're seeing red, rather than looking for the blue that we just know used to be there and that is somewhere behind the red. And then about the Dharmakaya. So when we do kind of touch into this Dharmakaya, when we do connect to this great freedom, when we do have some version of start to feel some freedom, some version of space to move, some way to choicefully inhabit our lives, or when we have the side effect of meditation, that is maybe bliss, or maybe a still, quiet mind, or those things. Now, those things are side effects. They aren't things that indicate good meditation. They aren't things that we strive after. That's just another way of it. That's kind of like, you know, sometimes things are a particularly unusual shade of kind of mauve. You know, that's what enlightenment is. It's this weird kind of shade of mauve. But mauve is not a better version of blue or red. So, about the Dharmakaya, the first are also, there are also two sicknesses. First is if you reach the Dharmakaya, but fall and remain there, and do not extinguish your own opinion about it. I just totally love that phrasing. That's the phrasing of the variety that we use of the in the koan translations that we have from John Tarrant and Joan Sutherland. There's another version of that line, which I think is kind of that I'm not even going to read you. So, but you fall and remain there, and it just sounds. I mean, that also kind of captures that kind of it happens sometimes. But so this is when the mind is quiet, when we're really seeing, or when we have some kind of luminous, sparklingly enlightenment experience, when we kind of grasp onto that, when we try to stick there, when we use zazen as a place to hide, as a way to suppress our lives, suppress our experiences, suppress our thoughts, that's practicing in a ghost cave. That isn't living our lives, it isn't serving and saving all beings, which is the practice of the ultimate goal of Mahayana Buddhism, of which Zen is a part. So when you fall and remain there, as opposed perhaps to just passing through, to visit, drop in, see what that's like, and then move along. And so one of the descriptions of what Zen practice is to let come all that comes and let go all that goes. But when we fall and remain there, we're grabbing on, we're creating kind of artificial stasis. And do not extinguish your opinion about it. So this comes up in the form, this opinion that we're talking about here is the subtle forms of aversion and attachment that arise, where we start to prefer one variety of zazen, we start to prefer to feel calm and compassionate and connected to stuff, and we start to become averse to ourselves when we're confused, when we're lost, when we're seeing a color other than that lovely shade of mauve. Or when we prefer zazen periods that lead to the side effect of bliss or relaxation or great insight. When we prefer those to the zazen periods that are just our monkey mind swinging from branch to branch and tree to tree and we're sitting there jittering, you know, about to jump out of our skins. And we're sure that this obviously is not the way we're supposed to be. And we start to prefer that. And this is this particular sickness is the traditional sickness of Zen in its monastic incarnation. So for most of its history, Zen has been practiced mainly by monastics, mainly by people who kind of do it 24/7 in a monastery and don't and spend lots of time in meditation, perhaps doing a week of intensive retreat every month, and then maybe some shorter retreats, and then on the non-retreat weeks, 4 hours of meditation a day, and somehow believe that that is the real Zen. And so this sickness is getting stuck in emptiness, getting stuck in these rarefied states of a quiet mind, and thinking that the quiet mind is the special kind of mind that we should have, should attain. And then, on the other side, and related to that, and do not extinguish our opinions about it. Or we think that everybody really should be practicing Buddhism the way we are, that everybody, ideas about our own virtuousness, about our own practice. So, in affirming faith in mind, it says the great way is not difficult for those who did not pick and choose, or the great way is not difficult, only cease to cherish your opinions. So we don't need to not have opinions, we don't need opinions to not arise, but when they do arise, to practice not cherishing them. But if we keep our opinions, if we hold on to our opinions about maybe something special like Zen practice, or keeping the precepts, or passing koans, or any of these things, if we cling to those opinions, then we're falling into this third sickness. So, second, if you think it is wrong to give up after enlightenments and minutely examine your own consciousness and find there is no scar, that too is a sickness. Another translation is, when, however, you look at it, the question arises, what inadequacy can there be? This is also a sickness. So maybe at some point we actually do have an experience of, wow, you know, everything actually is fine, just as it is. And which is really one of the great gifts of Zen practice, to be able to receive everything just as it is, and to see the perfection of things just as they are. So when you see that, when you have an insight into that, or you have an experience of that, and then you then let go of everything else, and you're like, you know, everything is fine just as it is, so I'm going to pick back up with my killing and lying and cheating and all of those things that the precepts suggest are not particularly useful ways to go. Because those are fine too. And, you know, on the one hand, that's true, but on the other hand, that's total sophistry and garbage. And so this is an opportunity. But this is also what some teachers call Buji Zen. Hey man, you know, everything I do is Zen. I don't need to practice. It's all Zen. You know, I mean, yeah. But on the other hand, what is that? This is an opportunity. This is where real compassion and real intimacy can enter. When we're able to engage with things just as they are, recognize the perfection of things just as they are, including the perfection of our inability to currently recognize the perfection of things as they are, and just being with that, and continuing in the kind of one foot after another, one moment after another, this moment, this moment, this practice of Zen. John Tarrant says, so intimacy is something that we talk about, intimately inhabiting this moment of our life, intimately connecting with things just as they are. And John Tarrant has this to say about intimacy. Intimacy is a modest and tender name for the connection with spirit attained after long wandering. And he also says, clarity reveals ordinariness. So when the light does penetrate through, when we really see, the thing we see is utterly ordinary. And when everything has been taken away, what is natural remains. And so this naturalness, this nothing specialness, this ordinariness in which we kind of encounter each moment as it is and respond with our open heart or our open and breaking heart, with our broken heart. This is the naturalness that is expressed as reaching behind our heads in our sleep to adjust the pillow. That's also, there's a koan that uses that image as an expression of Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion's thousand hands and eyes manifesting. So without thought, without idea, without calculation. And there's another story that I really love that also gives an expression of that kind of naturalness and kindness without calculation. It's a story about Layman Pong, a great lay Zen practitioner in ancient China, and his daughter. Layman Pong was selling bamboo baskets, and he was walking into market, and he fell in a puddle of mud, and then his daughter, and the whole Pong family, Layman Pong and Mrs. Pong and daughter Pong, they were all enlightened, it said. And so daughter Pong, the enlightened little girl, sees her father slip and fall in this mud, and then she dives into the mud puddle next to her, and her father says, what are you doing? And she says, I'm helping. And then he chuckles and says, well, it's lucky no one was watching. It's also good advice whenever you're trying to help and do good deeds. Make sure no one's watching. And that willingness to dive into the mud of our own experience, to dive into the mud of this messy world we live in. That's the cure for this fourth sickness. So I'm going to leave that there. Leave a long space now to see if anybody occurs to anything you want to ask about or say or express or something. Directly related, quasi-related, unrelated. About the mud. Good. Well, what do you imagine health is? Well, and what if he didn't think that he needed to be out of the mud? What if he was just thinking, mud, I've fallen in this big old puddle of mud. What a hoot. Well, that's a story you're telling yourself about that. So this that's you know you have a excellent knack to pick up on these kind of hooks that I throw out, and I don't want to steal from you by saying too much, but for me, when I look back on my life, one of the things I think that first kind of put me kind of on the lookout for something, you know, put me on the Zen path, but it was not anything to do with Zen. I had never heard of Buddhism or anything. It was when I was like, I was a kid. I was like maybe in seventh or eighth grade or something like that. And we were sitting down for dinner, and my dad was pouring a glass of Coke for himself. And he poured it in, and it like fizzed up, and it came. It was like it was pouring all. It came out all over the table, and he was so angry, and he was screaming and swearing, and he was really unhappy, and I remember thinking, that seems like a mistake to me. I don't think it has to go like that. And I think that in this story, Lehman Pong is not like my dad. I don't think he's, oh God, I'm in the mud. God, that's awful. And the mud is just another circumstance of his life. And he's meeting that circumstance open-heartedly and intimately by getting his white robe completely stained brown with mud. And his daughter seeing him joyfully dive into this big mess of mud that is his life, dove into the mess of mud that's her life, and shared it with him. And so there's a really, this koan is, that koan is so, for me, it's so, so sweet. It isn't that she was, I mean, in a way that it completely would not be if she, like, whipped out her stain remover stick and you know, and started trying to rub the mud off of him, you know? But there's so the willingness, there's a kind of willingness there, and there's a sweetness, and there's an intimacy, and also, I think that Lehman Pong is commenting. So I think that when he sees his daughter do this, and then he says, what are you doing exactly? And she tells him, I think that again, he chuckles, and I think that he's touched, and he appreciates the joy and the alacrity with which she dove into this moment in her life. And he appreciated in her that she had the aspiration to help, that she thought, I want to help, that I want to respond to this moment. And that is that aspiration is the entire thing. And then, because we never know, I mean, the things that we think are helping, if we're really trying to help in a kind of literal mathematical sense, are often not, given our limited view and our limited prediction of outcome, and also maybe we never know whether it helps or not. So and maybe we do some short-term harm, and maybe that short-term harm turns into long-term really harm or long-term benefit, but we don't know. But the aspiration is to help, and so he sees that and he's touched. And on the other hand, that's also, he also says, you might want to save that for at home. He also points out, I think lovingly, he acknowledges the reality that she just dove in some mud also. But that's not a bad thing. And it isn't a thing that needs to be fixed. And so she sees this thing that doesn't need to be fixed. And she gives rise to the aspiration to save all beings. And then she does this completely silly gesture, which adds nothing more to the state of affairs that didn't need to be fixed, nor does it make anything worse. And that's kind of that's the entirety of our path. That's the entirety of how we save all beings. Beings don't need saving, but they're suffering. We're not. And we have this aspiration. And what occurs to us to do might well be silly. But, and so this is me saying too much. But I want to invite you to really explore that and look for that helping and that mud in your own life, you know, and in your response to situations, and in your impulse to fix things that you think need fixing, or your impulses to not touch things because it might be too much of a mess to get into. Look for that, and then let me know what that's.
So what is a good lesson in life to come to some practice?
I don't know. I have no idea. That's lovely. And our wrong reasons for coming to Zen aren't problems. And we don't need to replace whatever reasons we have with the better reasons. I think they can be, because they can be, or they can be a kind of cycle, but it's not a matter of supposed to be, because it's not that you're supposed to get one sick one way and then supposed to get sick this other way and then supposed to get sick the third way, but the two latter sicknesses especially can't come at the beginning of practice because that isn't what is arising at the beginning of practice. But you don't need to think, oh my God, I haven't had that fourth sickness. I gotta get that. I gotta get me some of that. You know. They also might not come at all. But also they can, I think they're different perspectives on relating to a single moment, too. All right, you guys, thank you so much. I also want to mention...